Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 8th, 1999. In the fireside room this afternoon is our presenter, Donald Cobberly. Today's session number is 99-2, and it is titled Geology on the Right Side of the Brain 2, The Laws of Geology, Disregard Them at Your Peril. Let's listen to Don.
Coberly, this is the second session in a series of four sessions. The series title is Geology on the Right Side of the Brain. How many people weren't at the session yesterday up at the... Okay. The point of the idea of geology on the right side of the brain is it started out as a joke with a friend who used to be the artist in residence here at various times, and it... like jokes sometimes do, in time they have a little truth to them. And the truth of this, of the story is, the Marion who taught drawing on the right side of the brain, so I said, well, I'm going to teach geology on the right side of the brain. And the point of drawing on the right side of the brain is that you have to sort of change your perspective to be able to observe things. And by doing that, you can observe things better and you can draw better. Well, my analogy to geology is that geology is a science of observation. It's not a calculation science like mathematics is, where you put a formula up on the board and you put things in it and something comes out. Or an experimental science like chemistry is, where you go to the lab and you put stuff together and it explodes or it changes colors or something and you make some conclusion from that. To do geology, you have to go out and look at it. You have to go out and observe it. And then based on those observations, make some hypotheses about what you've seen. So what I was preaching yesterday and will continue to do this today is, what's the most basic stuff that you can go out and see? And let's talk about observing things the correct way, and then based on those observations, let's make some hypotheses or some guesses about what it means to the geology. The person that I sort of devised this idea for was someone who would be interested in using a book, and I talked about a series of books yesterday called the Roadside Geology series. I have three of them here. Washington, Arizona, and Colorado. There is one for Oregon, I know for sure. There's one for Idaho. I don't know about back east or the Midwest, how widely these are available. But the point of this book is, it has a road map and says if you're on Highway 97 and you drive to milepost 55, here's a picture of what you'll see. And so you can stop and look at the geology and try to figure things out and learn more that way. And what I'm trying to do in these sessions is give you a basic set of tools that you can take away with you that makes this easier, faster. That you can make some sense of some of the things that you will see and start to think in geologic ideas or geologic terms. Yesterday we talked about rocks. We'll do a 5-minute review of a 60-minute session of a year of mineralogy. There are three kinds of rocks, three major broad categories of rocks. Igneous rocks, which are ones that come from a molten state. Those are divided into intrusive rocks, which usually come up very slowly, cool at depth, and therefore are large. They have large crystals in them. The thing to think about is, if you take a solution of water and dump something in it until it's supersaturated, if you cool that solution very rapidly, the crystals don't have time to grow. If you let that cool over a long period of time, the crystals do have time to grow. So the size of the crystals that you see in the rock gives you some guess as to the depth that that rock, or the rate that that rock cooled at, and therefore the depth that it cooled at. Second kind of rock is sedimentary rock. Sediment is granular material or solid material moved by a fluid. Air moves sand dunes. Water moves a lot of stuff, like Railroad Creek, or water in its solid form called ice, which is glaciers, and those move material. And material that is dumped by that, or is carried by that fluid, is called sediment. It gets dumped out someplace where the energy drops out of the fluid. More stuff gets put on top of it. It gets lithified. It gets turned into a rock. That's called a sedimentary rock. Can you turn that on for a second, Kathleen? Somebody kicked the cord out there. And we talked about, for sedimentary rocks, the things to start thinking about as you see these is the grain size. What are the size of the pieces that make up the rock? And if it's little pieces, then it had to have been some relatively low energy system that was moving it. The range of grain sizes that you find. If you find little pieces and you find big pieces, that means something different than if you find all little size pieces. And again, trying to relate that back to what was the energy of the system that moved it and put it in place. So that the rock called shale, which is a very widespread rock, it's made out of clay, that forms in quiet oceans. So that it's the last stuff that sort of gets out of the system and out into the ocean, and now these very small particles fall. Anything that's heavier has been left somewhere behind, up on the beach or up in the mountains. If it's cobbles, they get left in Railroad Creek. If it's sand, it makes it to the beach. If it's clay, it gets out to the ocean. So oceanic rocks, primarily you find are shale, very fine grained stuff. At the beach, it's sand size. Up in the mountains, it may be cobbly or bouldery size. So the grain size that you find, the range of grain sizes that you find, if you find a variety of the range of grain sizes, that generally indicates it's a more energetic event that places it there. I'll try to explain that a little bit better in just a second. The fragments that you find, if they're rounded, that means generally something. We talked yesterday about the environment being a big rock tumbler. That once a rock gets exposed at the surface and falls off of buckskin or copper and tumbles down the hill, now it gets into a big rock tumbler. If it gets transported into Railroad Creek, it gets rolled down the creek and gets tumbled some more, and so the more time it spends in the rock tumbler, the rounder it gets. So if you look at the base of the avalanche chute and go out there and pick up a handful of stuff, a lot of the fragments are real angular, they're real sharp, they're real pointy, because they haven't spent any time in the rock tumbler yet. They've come down the hill and tumbled a little bit, but they don't get into the creek and spend that time getting rounded and smooth. And the place that you spend more time in the rock tumbler is at the beach. And so if you go to the beach and you look at a handful of beach sand, you will find the grains are relatively rounded. They're probably about the same size, and they're probably about the same material, a very resistant kind of rock. Angularity, grain size, range of grain size. We talk about anything else?
You don't have that little jar, those little ones that look like pearls?
I don't have it with me today.
Next time, it's amazing. It's real.
Okay. I'll bring it tomorrow. And when we're doing the review tomorrow, we can do it again. And so we took this, I showed this picture and handed out some color pictures to folks to say, all right, let's talk about this and let's use this as an example of a sedimentary rock. This is a man-made sedimentary rock called concrete. This is a wall, but the same principle applies in that you have this, the wider gray stuff is relatively fine grain. You can't see it. The range of materials, there's a relatively widespread range of materials. If we were going to be real serious about this, we could take one piece of the picture and measure every grain and make a distribution chart and say we have X number, 20% of the rocks are this size, and 20%, it gets real complicated, but then you get a degree for it. And so to me, the point here is when you have that range of grain sizes, the material that it comes down in has to be relatively thick if it were water that we're transporting it, it wouldn't transport all this different grain size ranges to the same place. It would be more sorted out. So if you saw all pebbles this size, you could say, yeah, it's a relatively energetic stream. If it was all things, you know, this size, you could say, well, it's a little quieter stream. Or if it was all fine grain stuff, you'd say it's got to be in the quiet somewhere. And so in this case, that fluid has to have some viscosity to it, and it turns out to be, yeah, the cement that this is made out of when it was pumped out to make this wall had some viscosity to it. So lots of information you can get from sedimentary rocks, and they are the most abundant. 70% of rocks that you find at the surface are sedimentary rocks of one kind or another. The last kind of rock is called a metamorphic rock. My way of thinking of this that I will suggest to you is you think of metamorphosis as a caterpillar turning into a butterfly. I had that wrong yesterday, but I've looked it up in the book overnight, and it's caterpillar to butterfly. But what metamorphosis means is a change. And so what a metamorphic rock is a rock that's been changed. And the two conditions, the two physical conditions about the surface of the planet or near the surface of the planet that can change are pressure and temperature. And so if you take this fine-grained sedimentary rock that we call a shale, and you push on it and you compress it some more, the shale turns into a rock called slate, which is about the same stuff, only it's more dense, and it breaks into real nice flat planes, and so they use it for blackboards and pool tabletops. Then if you push on it some more, but instead of just weight on top, if you push on it on the sides, it starts to get wavy a little bit. And the grains start to align because there is a chemical principle or a thermodynamic principle that once the grains start to segregate a little bit, it's a lower energy state is what the thermodynamic people call it. It's the way the rock would prefer to be is the way I call it. If you continue to press on it, not only do the grains start to align, but they start to segregate out into bigger bands of separate kinds of minerals, and I don't think we show that very well in any of these rocks, but it gets sort of layered so that you get these different stripes from dark to light to dark to light, and
move to the light. There!
That's good.
Same rock you looked at yesterday. It hasn't changed since then. It gets these stripes in it because not only have the grains aligned, they've started to separate out into small layers of like material. That's, again, an energetically lower state, and under the pressure and temperature change, that's what the rock will tend to do. You go from that slate, which is the shale that's been weighted down, to a rock called schist, and that's the stuff that has the little shininess to it because those are little mineral flakes, and maybe some waviness to it that indicates the direction of pressure. And then you come to a rock called gneiss, which is the rock that gets banded. All right, let's turn that off for a little bit, and we'll go back to lights here and talk about other stuff. That's yesterday. Today, I want to go through some very basic principles of geology. Things that when I think I talk about them, you will go, oh, that makes a lot of sense. It's very simple. And it's the basic, you know, it's addition and subtraction and division and multiplication in mathematics. It's the operations that we use as geologists to say, here's how we're going to make this picture come together. It's the basic concepts. The first one is the principle of uniformitarianism. And what that says is the processes that we see around us today are very likely the processes that have occurred over geologic time. Rivers run downhill. Rivers have sediment in them. Where it gets slower, the sediment gets deposited. It's not like gravity didn't apply 300 million years ago. Okay, so the things that we see happening today, volcanoes explode today like they used to. Now, very early in the Earth history, that probably wasn't true, but for enough of Earth's history to matter, it's been that case. So the things that glaciers come down valleys in Alaska today, we assume that that's what happened in the glaciation in Gondwanaland 250 million years ago. That water froze, came down the mountains, carried the same material, the same kind of material today, the same way it did back then. The simplest phrase for that, and it's the phrase that James Hutton came up with, is the present is the key to the past. What we see happening today is the same stuff that happened over geologic time. So that's the principle of uniformitarianism. Prior to that, and prior to 1788, when he, I have a picture that we'll show later that's in your packet, prior to his walking out to a rock outcrop and saying, this isn't the way they've been telling me it is, there were two events in geologic history, creation and Noah's flood. That's it. Those are the only two events. It made geology a really simple science. The course was about a day. I don't know, but you wouldn't have to go 4 years to, or 6 years to get a degree, so. Hutton went out and looked at rocks and saw that something was different, and geology was born, and I got to study it, now I got to come here. Okay, the laws of geology. You can disregard the laws of geology. It's not that big of a deal. It's not like I made it out in the title. Okay, first one is called original horizontality. Rocks get laid down flat. That's it. Since 70% of the rocks that we find are sedimentary rocks, and since 70% of the surface of the planet is covered by water, and that's where sedimentary rocks get laid down, this law of original horizontality applies primarily to sedimentary rocks. But if you think about the physics of it, and this isn't really hard, if you're a particle out in the ocean somewhere and you get laid down in a layer, those layers are going to be flat. They're not going to be standing up on end. They're not going to be on an angle. They're going to be flat. And so flat layers get built up. Now, this is not completely true. This is a generality. Volcanic rocks at Mount St. Helens, if you were to cut Mount St. Helens in half and move half of it away so that you could see a cross-section of it, those layers get laid down on an angle. It's not always true, but as a first guess, and for the most rocks, it applies. And the point of that then is, if you see rocks that are in layers and they're up on their end, they didn't get put down that way, you have to do two things. First, you have to lay them down flat, and then you have to tip them up on end. So, this was a law or a concept first talked about by Nicholas Steno, who was Polish or Czechoslovakian, and this is 1560 or 1600, something like that. Okay. Oh, by the way, in your packet, this idea of the present being the key to the past is sort of shown in the first page. That on the left-hand side is a picture of a mud pot or a mud spring occurring today, and you can see as the little mud blobs up, it leaves these concentric circles in a real specific pattern. If you look at the picture on the right, do you want to?
Oh, well, we can share.
Okay.
We're friends.
All right. If you look at
the, I'd love to have.
If you look at the one on the right, there is sort of a fossil set of mud blobs. And so the theory is that what we see today also used to happen. Okay. Law of superposition. When rocks get laid down flat, based on the law of original horizontality, where are the old rocks and where are the young rocks? The old rocks are on the bottom. If you have a series of layers that get built up over time, and you assign T T1 through T5, with T1 being old. This better be T1. Older at the bottom and younger at the top. The only other, if you try to make it happen the other way, you've got to sort of tuck in rock layers and pick up everything on top of them, and that doesn't make a lot of sense. So this law of superposition is whatever you find on the top of the stack is probably the youngest rock in the area. Now, if you don't have, and this is very useful in all cases, and one of the places that you can use it very nicely is if you're studying volcanic rocks, rocks that come up out of volcanoes and then spread out all over the place. Because if you find one unit, one lava flow lying on top of another lava flow, you can either say, okay, the one on top flowed over the one on the bottom, or the one on the bottom sort of wormed its way underneath the one on top. Which one of those is a more likely situation? The first one. I don't have any real good pictures of lava flows, but I have an excellent analogy, which is the color photo that you have second on your packet, which is if you burn a bunch of candles at your house and you burn them on the same plate, sooner or later you will have a candle wax layer system that you can then figure, if somebody were to come by later on, they could say, okay, I'm going to figure out what order Don burned these candles in by looking at what little layer sits on top of what next little layer. And as today's first assignment, let's take about 3 minutes and figure out from this picture what order I burned those candles in. Now, I was trying to be sly here and burn a green candle at the start and another one at the end. And then when I looked at the picture, it confuses the heck out of everything. So I'm going to tell you that when you think of the order that I burn candles in, and you make your little list, you should have green, and that's that. It was a dark green, so it may look black to you. And we'll say this is old, and this is young. And in this case, old means Saturday night, and young means Tuesday night. In geologic time, it would be different, but that's what happened. Because I was packing to come up here, and I was under a lot of pressure. So in between here, I don't know how many other colors there are, red, white, and blue. So by looking at which lays on top of which, we should be able to put this together. So I'm going to look at it with Karen to see if I can figure it out. And
turquoise.
Green, white, green, red, white, blue,
red,
green, blue,
I think
green, white, blue, red,
kind of gone off to the side.
Black.
There's no black though.
Blue, red, blue, white, red. This color, he's kind of green. Blue, red, blue,
white, red.
Blue,
red,
blue, white, red.
I would say red.
So blue's got to be old.
The youngest.
Okay.
And then
I
like it.
I think it's a little off the side.
Yeah.
All right.
Youngest.
Kathleen, could you turn that on again and throw that picture up? You will get extra credit for this.
Will I?
Yes. Next one.
Is that right? No. Like that?
Good enough. Okay, what's the votes here? Blue for old, green is at the bottom, right? Because I told you. And then blue next. Does everybody like that?
Yeah.
And the reason I think that is sort of by because you see at one point you see red on top of blue here,
red on,
and you see white on top of blue here. Yeah. Is there any time you ever see blue on top of anything that isn't green? Okay, so next is blue, and then here we have white on top of blue, so we know that that's younger, And we have red on top of blue. So now the question is, which of these two is younger? And right here, you have red running on top of white. There's a little confusion here. I think this red came off to the side here and was sitting, sort of has flowed off the edge, and now it's also on top of blue, so that's still good. Here's blue on top of green, so this green is this old green. And someplace, you got green on top of everything else, so that's what the confusion would be. So that's volcanic geology through candle wax. And the point of throwing the green in there to sort of confuse things was, when you're out studying geology in the field, there are times when you have geologic flows of very different ages that appear very similar. And if you get caught up into thinking, okay, every place I see this black rock with the white crystals in it, it's all the same thing, and you start to do what we've done here, what was the answer? Red, white?
White.
Okay. If you go to some place and you say, okay, here's my stack, and then all of a sudden you start finding green on top of it again, you go, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? I got green at the top and I got green at the bottom. It's either that thing that you had some lava flow that went like this, of green, how did it go uphill? We don't know that. And then this stuff came in sideways, or else you've got maybe two different lava flows that look about the same as each other. So what geologists do in the field down in Arizona, where they have lots of volcanic stuff, is you walk around and you look at stuff and you say, okay, here's a unit, here's a pinkish lava flow, and on top of it is this green stuff. And you look at it and you make your evaluation, and you move along to some other place and you map it there, and you map it all kinds of different places, and then at some point either have a coherent picture, everything matches with each other, or when you get back into this situation where you find green in two different places, you either need to explain why those have come out the way they have, this scenario that I've gotten that doesn't seem real reasonable, or maybe you have two lava flows that are relatively the same stuff. You send the stuff off to the lab and they cut thin sections out of it and they investigate it more closely and they say, yeah, it's different rock. That's the law of superposition. Now, the same thing applies to sedimentary beds. As long as you know that the beds are in their original orientation. Now, we talked about original horizontality, and so if we find rocks that are tipped up on end, sometimes if they're tipped up straight on end, sometimes it's hard to tell which way it was up. Well, you have a couple of handouts in your packet to help you tell which way is up. That's the next two things. And you say, okay, what's the big deal? Stuff has got to be laid down flat. How often do you find this stuff that gets laid up on end, or sometimes it gets tipped over 90 degrees and it's called overturned? Well, the closest overturned sediments that we can find to this building are right there and right there. This whole package of sedimentary rock has been tipped up on end, and the ore body, well, it's been tipped up on end this way, it has actually been tipped up to over 90 degrees. And so the ore body, when you look at the geology of it, it's opposite of what you anticipate. You find rocks that are like laying like this, and your first inclination is that those got tipped up on end. Well, in fact, they got tipped up this way and have been tipped past the horizontal. How can we tell that? There's a series of 8 or 10 different ways that you can go about looking at that. Let's just pick a few out. This idea of graded bedding, if you're out in Railroad Creek, the way that if you cut a cross-section of successive stream channels, as Railroad Creek has wandered back and forth across the valley, it lays down a layer of sediment, and then the angle of the creek changes depending on what's happening in the mountain. Are the mountains coming up higher than we're filling up down here? The creek may come back across. You'll find these graded beds are relatively coarse at the bottom and get a little finer and then become very fine. And then you'll find another package that's coarse at the bottom and In this case, the course is at the base, and so if you see those layers, if you see layers in the rocks here that are coarse, and then a little finer, and then a little finer, you go, wait a minute, this stuff's been pitched over more than 90 degrees.
So is that the case with this ore body? Is that how you know that it's gone over?
I don't know what specific of these criteria have been used to determine that. I know that they feel that the ore body's been it's overturned. Here's one. If you have scours in layers, this indicates that there's been a stream channel that's probably dug into it a little bit. Flip this over for just a second, please. Or spin it. There we go. The other way to look at that is we have these little humps that have been formed, right? And so we have to invoke some physical principle that says all of a sudden out in the world you have these little humps that you see in places, like sort of mole burrows or something. I don't know if you're in your yard or at the golf course and you see these little humps, you think there's something burrowing along, right? Well, this is hard to explain. It's a lot easier to think that there's a stream channel out there making these little scours, so that if you're out walking around and you see these scours, you'll see them like that. You can either say, all right, this is right side up and here are these humps that have been formed, or it's been overturned and these are scour channels. So you have a couple of pages of that to show you which way is up. Once you decide that your package is in the right order, hasn't been overturned, then you can say oldest at the bottom, youngest at the top. Okay. Law of inclusions, including chilled margins and bake zones. Let's think of for a minute if we have a rock that's in place and we inject, it has a fracture in it, and hot material comes in along that fracture. This is a real common thing in geology, that a rock that has been formed for a long time will be fractured by tectonic forces, by big pressure forces, and it'll crack. Hot material is coming up. Slowly, it finds one of these cracks and shoots along the cracks. What happens to the material that's being put into place, and what happens to the material around it? First off, is this stuff is coming in under some pressure as it starts to become thicker. It may take pieces of the in-place rock and rip them out and move them along. Here's our in-place rock. And here's the fracture that something might be moving along. You'll find little pieces of this intact rock included in. And these are things that I'm hypothesizing that this stuff was forced in over here and has taken little pieces of this rock and included it. So it's called an inclusion. Second thing is that might happen is the stuff in the fracture, as it's closer to the in place rock, it will cool more rapidly. This rock here is cooler than the rock inside. And so what you find is the grain sizes are smaller. It's the same thing we talked about in our extrusive versus intrusive rocks. It cooled more rapidly along the margins, and so you will find small crystals at the margins, and you will find larger crystals in the middle. The third thing that might happen is what's called a bake zone. It's this hot material being injected in, and so right along the boundary of the cold rock, you may find a bake zone, and the way that shows up is, again, there's a segregation of the minerals, and so it looks, depending on what the mineralogy, the way the composition of it is, this stuff will either appear lighter or darker, but there will be a little halo right along that area. Now, this is not just a theoretical concept. This has some basis in reality. If you'll flip about two more slides, your next page, and this is a field notebook written by a struggling geology student back in 1981 that I know, that we can tell can't draw very well, for one thing, and also is kind of a suck up. I knew my instructor was going to read this thing. This is my field book, and it's lots of instructive features. If I said that now, I'd kind of barf. Okay, so an exploration pit at the base of the saddle. Lots of instructive features. This is my drawing of a pit that was dug into the side of this hill, and there was this dike, this material that got put in along the crack. Here's our crack, and here is the in-place material. Dike of KG, K is a age designation, G I assume was for granite. This is a long time ago, so I don't remember very well. Cuts through main body of KQM, which was another K age, QM for quartz monzonite, another kind of rock. A chill zone is present in the dike. That's what we said we were gonna get. Faster cooling equals finer grain. The bake zone occurs in the surrounding wall rock. The recrystallization seems to make the parent rock darker. That's the stuff in place. A xenolith, which is what you call these bits that get picked up of the KQM, is present. That's it. Stuff you need to do. This is another good thing if you're trying to suck up your geology professor. Write stuff down for next time and see. He says good. The point is, in the end, what's the age, if we're comparing the age of this stuff to this stuff? This stuff is younger, right? The only, what the converse of that would be, if this were somehow older, you'd have to get these fragments of rock into an older rock. Now, how you get younger rock into little blebs into the middle of an older rock without some sort of fracture, that's a real hard way to get it there, right? There's no real good way. So when you see these, when you see an inclusion or a xenolith, you can assume that that's an older rock. It has to be. There's no way that you can get a younger rock in there without a fracture or some way to get it there. So in this case, it shows that this stuff is the older rock and the injected stuff, the intruded stuff, is the younger rock. Okay. Cross-cutting relationships. I need two people to help me with this. It won't hurt. It's pretty simple. And it would be a big help. So, Karen and Jim. All right.
Do you want this off? Yeah,
that'd be great. You're blue tape dude. And you're masking tape, dude. And if you want to go over there, and you're going to put blue tape from this corner to this corner. And you're going to put masking tape from this corner to this corner. Okay? You're watching. Everybody's watching. This is not a magic trick. This is a scientific demonstration. Okay. Okay, now switch and do the same thing.
Okay.
Same corners.
Same thing you told us.
Same. Yep. You do this. You do the same corners that you did before. Well, no. I don't think you did.
No, same corners you did before.
Yep. Thank you very much. You've been a big help. Okay, so over here it was masking tape and it equals old, and blue tape equals young, right?
Yeah.
Here it was blue tape, old, and masking tape, young, right? Everybody saw that.
Yeah.
Based on what you've seen, what you know happened, and what you've seen, can you come up with some idea that we can use to say we're going to tell which is the old stuff and which is the new stuff?
Well,
one on top of the other.
Yes, sir.
Well, this one, the masking tape's over the blue tape, and over there, the blue tape's over the masking tape.
Exactly. Now, without, if you were looking at this and you couldn't go, yeah, I can tell that's on top, what you could look at is, in this case, the blue tape gets cut by the white tape. You have blue tape, you have blue tape, and if you couldn't see through this, you would have white tape over top of it, right? The blue thing, if it were a geologic layer, it gets cut by the white stuff. Mm-hmm. Over here, the masking tape gets cut by the blue stuff, right? So it's the idea of cross-cutting relationships is younger things cut older things, okay? That's it. So that if you find something, and the same thing applies here, younger things cut older things. Got it? That's it. That's all the geology you need. Now, everything that we talked now, let's see where we are in this stuff. The next thing is a series of 5 or 6 pages in your packet. And if you could put up that slide, that would be really helpful. One, there's a bunch of box diagrams on it. Page 44. We can start to think about geology more, or we can start thinking about all this goofy stuff we've done more in terms of geology than tape, by thinking about layers of rock getting laid down and then what might happen to them. Here's a series of rocks that got laid down horizontally, probably sedimentary rocks. Law of original horizontality applies. Oh, I could do some more stuff on this. We could cut that off, which would be the equivalent of a fault, let's say, and tape it back up, but because the units have been offset, let's say I'm in a hurry and I tape it back up kind of sideways where we did. The fault cuts both the blue tape and the masking tape, right? Mm-hmm. The fault is therefore younger than the blue tape or the masking tape. We proved that because you just saw it. And then I could tape this across here and say, okay, this thing doesn't get offset by the fault, therefore it's younger. So we can, from those things, say, what's the order of things that happen? Masking tape first, blue tape second, fault or cutting third, red ribbon fourth. Okay, geology. Same deal, only instead of blue tape and masking tape, we have different rock layers, and we can tell them because for some reason they're characteristic. This one is white, and this one is pink, and this one has certain minerals in it that we can identify. For some reason, let's say these get laid down flat. We're in a quiet sea right off the Front Range of Colorado, where Denver is today, and then all of a sudden the Rocky Mountains start to come up. These rocks get tipped up on end. Now it's Red Rocks where the concert hall is, or Garden of the Gods along the Front Range. Once things get tipped up on end, they get up higher into the environment. Erosion starts to take place and things get laid down flat. So now you have these angled rocks that are tipped up on end. They've been worn down to flat, and now the Rockies have grown behind us and are now transporting sediment down rivers. That stuff gets laid down relatively flat, and now you have new rock layers built up. They're flat because it's original horizontality. And so if you go someplace and look at the geology of Colorado, or if you look at the geology of a road cut, you may very well see this. And tomorrow I will show you a picture even more striking than this, that's real in the world from Glenwood Springs, Colorado, that shows this scenario very clearly. That's the way geology works. So, that's that. Where are we on time?
4:32.
And what's shown in the rest of these is just complications and permutations of the stuff we have just talked about. So that we could, and in there's another one of the block diagrams, the one that we skipped past, that shows what happens when you have a fault. Can you throw that one up, Catherine? No, it's page 43. Yep, perfect. What isn't shown in this is the original orientation of these three units, which are 1, 2, 3, laid down flat. 2 is this black layer. For some reason, we can trace it easily when we're out looking. And then a fault happens and throws up a block of material in relation to the other. Over time, more material gets put in from an outside source, gets laid down flat. My gripe with this is you probably won't have this so sharp in the subsurface that as material is being laid down, it will have a tendency to round that off so that you won't ever see anything like that. But now if you're confronted with this block, you will look at this layer and say, wait a minute, younger cuts older, therefore if this is the same material on both sides, this fault must therefore be younger than our black layer, our black unit. Up here, the fault doesn't cut this fourth unit, therefore the fourth unit must be younger than the fault. Okay, so let's stop for a second and pick one of the boxes to look at on your page 47 and see if we can figure out what the heck happened. How about let's take a couple of minutes and look at letter B and see if we can figure that one out. Come up with some sort of geologic history of the area. Kathleen, tell me.
Which one?
B was the one I was looking at.
B?
Sorry, did I?
Okay. I can tell you all about D, but I can't.
Really?
Really?
No, I'm kidding.
Because I can't make head or tail of it. So. All right, here's
the top layer. Or the second layer is the youngest. The top layer is the youngest.
This layer?
Yeah.
Okay, I like it.
That's next youngest?
This is next youngest.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
All the next.
The fault is next. Okay. I like that. And
for the speckle one.
Sorry?
How do you count
the next layer?
These things?
No, right now the layer.
The next one.
The next layer is like
the other one.
The third layer and the last one here, the one that's has a disruption.
Okay. Well, I gotta think about this.
That's fourth.
Does this
yes.
Fourth. Fourth. Fourth.
That's it.
1, 2, 3, 4,
yeah.
5,
yeah.
6, 7, 8. Mm-hmm. And my thinking is that this layer was originally continuous prior to the fault and got pushed up into the environment and got eroded away, and that's why we don't see it anymore on the upside of the block. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you see little fragments of it. And can we
hypothesize that since we see a fragment of it over here, that maybe whatever deposited it was flowing this way and carrying some of it that way. The other alternative is, I don't know what the other alternative is, that somehow that fragment got left behind as, yeah, it was a big enough boulder that it got left behind. But if this was a small stream that was doing this eroding, and this thing's the size of a van. So we don't have we don't have enough information to be able to sort that out one way or the other. Okay, this surface, this erosion surface here, is what's called an unconformity. And we're back on schedule here. And I just want to talk to you for a minute about this, what an unconformity means. And if you go through that lab exercise, and the next page that you have is this one right here, and Kathleen is going to throw the slide up for us to look at real briefly. And can you slide down just a titch? Thank you. How is it that we form this surface that we call an unconformity? And it's just this the series of things that we've talked about. You get a series of sediments that are laid down flat. They get folded during mountain building. And I think about fold. If you take a piece of carpet and push on it from the sides, you get bows and waves in it. The next thing that happens is these bows, since they're higher up in the environment, physics argues that there will be more erosion at the top of the mountain than there will be at the bottom, since it likes to level everything out. You will erode down to a certain level and then have a flat level, and then more material, if creeks are still running across, that more material will be deposited on top of it. Now, this, if you take it out of being a drawing and take it into being a picture, is the next picture that you have, which, yeah, please. And this is what's known as Hutton's unconformity. James Hutton is the founder of modern geology. This is 1788. James Hutton was a farmer that was making enough money that he had free time on his hands and was out driving around, or horse carriaging around, what do you call it, riding around in Scotland, and came across this point that's called Sicker Point. And to me, this is the birthplace of modern geology. So that if you're a geologist, this is like St. Andrews is to golfers, or Wrigley Field is to baseball, or I don't know. What's the church? Where's the church that Martin Luther hammered up the stuff that he did? Or where do Lutherans go? Minnesota. Wittenberg. Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, when they go to Mecca for the whatever they call that, pilgrimage. Yeah. Okay. And it's like some of these other things, it's not all that stunning when you really look at it. But the point is, and this is, let me get on the soapbox for a minute. To me, there are these times, this is sort of the philosophy of science. There are times in science or in reality that people see the same things that everybody else has seen and interpret them differently. When Archimedes got in the bathtub and the water went up and he said, "Eureka, I found it, the principle of buoyancy," he wasn't the first person ever to get in the bathtub. But he's the one that says, "Oh, there's some meaning to this." And when Isaac Newton was sitting under the apple tree and got hit in the head, if that really happened or whether the apple fell next to him, it wasn't the first time that that had ever happened to anybody. And he said, "Oh, gravity." Or Copernicus, looking at the planets and watching their revolution and seeing the same thing in his telescope that other people had seen in theirs, and him saying, "The Earth isn't at the center of this. It's the sun. Well, like I said before, at the time in 1788 when James Hutton went out to Sickert Point, there were these two events in geologic history. Creation of the earth and Noah's flood. That's it. And he went out and he saw these parts of the layers are stood up on end. And right in here somewhere is this erosion surface. And then there are some more layers that appear to be flat, but they're tilted up a bit. And his thinking was, wait a minute, I see layers like this being laid down all the time in the shallow bays of Scotland, and it doesn't happen real fast. And by having 30 or 60 or 100 of these layers take a long time times 100, and then you got to do something to get them up from where in the world do we see stuff getting laid down, grain on top of grain on top of grain? That's pretty hard to do. So now we have to say, not only did it take a long time for these layers to get laid down flat, they get pushed up on end. And then there's some erosion that takes place. And then we get more layers that originally got laid down flat, and they got tipped up some more. And at that point, the age of the earth was figured to be about 6,000 years, based on an analysis of the generations present in the book of Genesis. Counted back, everybody got an age assigned to them. The earth was formed on October 26th or 28th in 4004 BC. Hutton said, wait a minute, 6,000 years isn't near enough time to do this. And geology was born. And the concept of geologic time started to have some relevance, and it is the concept of geologic time, the concept that the earth is tremendously old, 4.6 billion years. That's the philosophers of science see that idea is the biggest thing that geology has brought to science at large, is this concept of geologic time. And when an individual goes out and looks at the thing that everybody else has looked at and said, wait a minute, it ain't the way they've been telling me. That's how science improves. That's how science makes headway.
And I. Is he seen as nuts by people? I mean, especially if you mess with creationism.
Well, it was certainly a bit of a hard road at the start, and for a long time, I don't know that much about the sort of sociology of his stuff. I know a little bit more about the science of it. And one other issue, and that's this point of the unconformity, is if you have rocks laid up on end and an erosion surface and more rocks laid down on top of it, can you make any estimate of the age of that erosion surface? We could make some guess of how long it took to lay these rocks down. We could go someplace to a bay and jam a yardstick in and wait 5 years, and after 5 years we had this much more sediment. And we could say, okay, for each inch of sediment we need to take 5 years. And here, there we got X inches, we could come up with some rate of deposition. We could maybe make some guess as to how long it took things to get tipped up on end, or maybe we have some way to do that. For that erosion surface, for that unconformity, we have no idea by looking at it what time interval is there. And so when you go to the Grand Canyon and you look at a similar situation here, the majority of the time is in the unconformity. You have whatever it is, a mile of rock piled up on top of each other. The bottom rock is like this, and then you have an erosion surface, and then you have relatively flat rocks. And yet the greatest amount of time is in the part that isn't there. And that's, so it's one of those things that if you're thinking about and going out to look at geology and you see this unconformity, you see this erosion surface, and you go, okay, really long time, really long time, really long time, really short time, really long time, you may have missed the picture. It may be that surface represents the greatest change in time. that's a little bit of confusion to end the day with. And I've only run over by 3 minutes. Tomorrow, I have a series of overheads to look at and handouts to pass out that are simply slides and pictures of geology that I have taken over my time in doing this, and hopefully being able to relate it back to the things we've talked about today and the things we talked about yesterday as far as rock types and what we might be able to read from them. And my hope is that by showing you things, and then if you want to go and out and look at them, you can say, yes, this looks the same, or here's the concept that we've been talking about, and this is how it applies in not precisely the situation we've described it in, but whatever it is that you see. So that's what tomorrow is going to be about. It's going to be looking at geology pictures and me waving my arms and telling you what I think about. So 3:45 tomorrow. Be good to see you.
Thank you.